The headlines: the cost of living in the UK at its highest level in almost a decade, partly driven by higher household energy costs. Russia remains a COVID hotspot with a new daily record of deaths and staggering infections. Plus a sigh of relief for Sebastian Piñera. Chile Senate votes against impeaching the president over corruption allegations. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. And we're going to start this segment of the program with News Review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. Britons are paying a lot more for food, fuel, and accommodation, with the country's inflation rate surging to a 10-year high. Last month, the annual rate has jumped to 4.2%, the highest level since November 2011. That's more than double the target set by the Bank of England. Increased household energy bills, a rise in the cost of secondhand cars and fuel, and higher prices in restaurants and hotels are blamed for the surge. The reported spike in inflation prompted a drop in UK stocks compared to their European peers on Wednesday. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent, Syed Purezo, is joining us from the British capital, London. Also, we have economist, author, and commentator Steve Keen, who's joining us from Bangkok. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Saeed in London. Saeed, what do these numbers mean?
These numbers mean, Barry, that the inflation rate has risen, and it's probably going to continue rising. This, of course, comes months after a warning from the Bank of England governor, Andrew Bailey, who said that the inflation rate was going to rise in the coming months, but that it would be temporary, although there are a lot of other people who are saying that it will not be temporary. But how did we get here? The reasons can be sought in many different places. Some are related to the pandemic, others are not related to the pandemic. Some are a direct result of Brexit. For example, we saw the shortage of those semiconductor microchips that are used in cars, in smartphones, washing machines, and a lot of the other stuff that we use on a daily basis. When it comes to cars, for example, the shortage in semiconductors led to the slowing down of car production, and that has sent auto prices much higher than they used to be. I was talking actually today with someone who's just about to buy a car, telling me that he'd been told to either make up his mind, because he was test driving a car today, or he would have to run the risk of paying another £500 on top of the amount he had planned to buy a car. So you can tell where things stand. And then in September, we had the truck driver shortages, a direct result of Brexit. Those European drivers who left post-Brexit, never to come back, and there was nobody or not enough people to drive those trucks to carry fuel from refineries to forecourts or gas stations, and hence the long lines of motorists waiting to refill their tanks. And now people are really feeling the pinch at the pump. In addition to that, we had the natural gas and energy prices rise in this country. That, of course, after the regulator, Ofgem, allowed suppliers to increase the price cap to offset the impact of a global wholesale energy prices. And so what is happening is that households are really feeling the pinch at the moment. And, of course, those prices are meant to rise at the same time as a planned tax rise in April. As you can see, prices are continuing to go up. We also have the labor market contributing to this. The numbers that came out yesterday showing that the labor market really is not faring very well. There's also talk of the fact that some of the people post-furlough are not going back to work because the working conditions have changed. Some people have savings. They're not taking up the jobs they used to have, probably because they don't pay enough to really be able to pay for things as the inflation rate goes up, that seems to be a contributing factor to the inflation rates. And so what experts are saying that unless the Bank of England steps in whichever way it can, then we're going to have more pressure, see more pressure on household finances, and that will continue to impact the so-called post-pandemic recovery here.
Okay, we'll get back to you in a second, Sam. Let's cross over to Mr. Keane. Mr. Keane, give us your thoughts on how alarming this sudden surge in the annual inflation rate in the UK has been.
Well, let's put it in perspective. The inflation rates that caused the negative reaction economists have to inflation occurred back in the 70s and 80s, and you're talking inflation rates four times as high as are being talked about right now. And also what you had back in those days was a labor movement that was strong enough to ensure that if there were cost rises pushed through by things like the OPEC oil price rises, then they could instantly bargain for the wage rises to compensate for that, and you got what's called the wage price spiral. Now, I simply don't expect that to continue on this time round. And rather than this being a markup of the price of oil in a booming economy, which was the situation back in the 70s, this is a breakdown of the supply system caused initially by COVID, but also increasingly by climate change. So I don't think it's going to have anything like the usual effect. That's not saying it's going to be good, but I don't expect to see a spiral of inflation occurring afterwards. What I do expect is a lot of goods and services that working class people used to expect to be able to afford won't be in their menu anymore.
Mr. Keane, how much of the situation we're seeing right now, specifically when we're talking about the inflation in Britain, how much of that is attributed to what happened following the Brexit?
I'd say about a quarter, maybe a fifth. Brexit has certainly added to it. The whole experience with the truck drivers, which your correspondent mentioned, is obviously a major factor. And the Brits had nothing really worked out. There was no plan for Brexit. It was just a way for Boris Johnson to win the power. So it's chaotic, and that is part of the breakdown. But a lot of it really comes down to COVID and the impact now of the increasing difficulty of extracting energy from the ground. Fossil fuels are getting harder and harder to extract. That's giving more bargaining power to those with ample supplies, which includes Russia, of course. So you have geopolitics, global warming, and also COVID all striking at once. Brexit just is like stirring the pot. It's just adding to the confusion.
Zaid, I saw you nodding there. What are your final thoughts on the issue? Is, as Mr. Keane said, Brexit just stirring of the pot, or is there more than meets the eye into what's taking place right now when we think about the ripple effects of Brexit?
As Mr. Keane said, of course, Brexit is an important factor to factor into this whole thing. And I was nodding to the fact that a lot of the items that people used to have in their baskets or on their tables will probably be more difficult to have as a result of the rising inflation rate. And then there is the question of the performance of this government, you know, from the prime minister all the way down and add to it the so-called Tory sleaze and all the allegations against how this government and conservative MPs have been really lining their own pockets over the years by taking up second jobs and not declaring their earnings from those second jobs, while the rest of the people, the working class, continue to bear the brunt of their decisions, Brexit having been one of them. Arya.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Saeed Puruza speaking to us from London. And also thanks to Mr. Steve Keane, economist, author, and commentator, joining us from Bangkok. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here. Welcome back. The worrying upward trend of COVID cases and fatalities continues in many European countries, with the region now becoming the world's latest pandemic hotspot. Russia is reporting about 1,250 deaths, a new one-day record for the country. Also, over 36,000 new positive cases in one day. The vaccination program is very sluggish in the country due to the reluctance of the general population to get their shots. The Czech Republic is another European country struggling with an uptick in infections. More than 22,000 new cases registered there In one day, hospitals in many European countries are filled with patients and the health system struggling to cope. The coronavirus vaccine rollout is in full swing in Iran. The country now says the number of administered jabs has surpassed 100 million. Over 43 million people are fully vaccinated. That makes up for over 60% of the target population. Iran was among the hardest hit countries in the region, but thanks to large-scale imports of COVID shots and the domestic production, it has now managed to bring the pandemic under control. Over 6 million people have so far been diagnosed. 128,000 others have lost their lives. In Chile, an impeachment process against President Sebastian Piñera is now over, with the Senate declining to remove him despite a lower house vote last week over corruption allegations. The senators needed at least 29 votes in favor of impeachment, but they only got 24. The lower house of Congress approved the impeachment trial last week. Piñera is accused of using his presidency for business gains following the Pandora Papers leak recently. The documents reveal the offshore transactions of major political figures. According to those papers, Piñera has sold a mining company using a tax haven, but he denies the allegation. This was the second attempt to remove the president. The first one failed in 2019 over a crackdown on anti-government protesters. The drama for Piñera comes just days before Chileans will head to the polls to choose his successor. The U.S. Treasury Secretary says the government could be running out of money by mid-December. In a letter to lawmakers, Janet Yellen encouraged Congress to raise or suspend the U.S.'s debt ceiling as soon as possible in order to avoid a default. This comes as President Biden is seeking congressional approval for his climate and education spending plan, which amounts to $1.8 trillion. Republicans are opposed to the so-called Build Back Better plan. Back in October, the party also resisted raising the government's debt limit, almost causing the U.S. to default on its loans for the first time in history. Economists warned such an outcome would cause a catastrophic financial crisis. Even speaking to our Washington correspondent, Colin Campbell, he says, with holiday season around the corner and next year's midterm elections in sight, the government needs to fix the debt crisis sooner than later if it wants to avert the consequences.
Obviously, if the U.S. hits the debt ceiling without any type of amelioration, any kind of fix, this is bad for the credit rating for the U.S. This could put people on furlough. This is definitely not the predicament that the Biden administration would want to be in heading into 2022. One reason is the holidays. You don't want more people with economic woes and professional woes heading through the holiday season. Not only that, it's cold, so you have weather. You don't want people to be homeless. But then think about politically. 2022 is midterm elections. The Biden administration is already facing a very low approval rating, vice president even lower. Congress has been consistently low, and it's run by Democrats right now. If these approval ratings continually head into 2022 and a few months into 2022 with low approval ratings, it's not good news for Democrats. And so this could put the Biden administration in political peril if that debt ceiling isn't raised.
An envoy of the Venezuelan government was arrested last year in the African island of Cape Verde on a U.S. arrest warrant. Alex Saab was extradited to the United States last month to face trial on corruption charges. We've reached out to his wife, Camila Fabri, to hear more about Saab's condition. She's very critical of the way her husband was treated by the Cape Verde government.
The experience of him in Cape Verde was horrific, horrible, and he was tortured every single day, not only physical, but also psychologist. Torture, and also Alex is a survivor of cancer. The government of Cabo Verde never authorized the access of his medical of medical specialist to see him.
Fabri says the treatment came despite calls by international organizations to release Saab or stop his extradition. She says Saab was an envoy on a humanitarian mission and his political immunity had to be respected. But the Cape Verde government was ignorant of all of that and preferred to collaborate with the U.S.
They always claim the freedom, but at the end, they are nothing more than a vassal of the United States. They always follow the instruction of the United States.
Fabri believes this was all set up to pile pressure on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and to oust him from power. On Monday, Saab pleaded not guilty in a federal court in the U.S. after a judge dropped several money laundering charges against him. He's now facing a single charge. Caracas calls Saab's detention a kidnapping case. It's also suspended the talks with the opposition on ending the political crisis in Venezuela. Saab was a member of that negotiating team. People have held a protest in the Gaza Strip to voice their anger at an agreement between the U.S. and the U.N. Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees. Ruba Chavez has more from Gaza.
Political factions in the Gaza Strip, along with the Joint Committee for Refugees, gathered in front of the UNRWA office in the Gaza Strip to reject the framework agreement signed between the United States and the agency regarding the restoration of U.S. funding for the UNRWA. The demonstration comes in conjunction with the International Conference for UNRWA, where several donor countries are scheduled to convene in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden to discuss resuming the financial support to the UN agency and the Palestinian Authority.
We are holding this press conference based on our Palestinian people's demands all over the world. At the same time, the International Conference for UNRWA is being held in Brussels. UNRWA has been suffering from a critical impasse, and the victims of the shortage of aid are the poor Palestinian refugees. We are all united in expressing that we won't give up our right of return, and we have been calling for this right for 73 years. The international community is now in front of the real test whether to be committed to its conventions or not.
The framework for cooperation between the UNRWA and the U.S. for 2021-2022 calls for restoring U.S. funding to the UN agency after it was cut off for several years under former U.S. President Donald Trump. It includes that the U.S. will not make any contributions to UNRWA except on the condition that UNRWA ensures that no part of the U.S. contribution is used to assist any refugee receiving military training as a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organizations. UNRWA provides services, especially in health and education, for more than 5.5 million Palestinian refugees. Palestinians say that UNRWA must remain committed to its duties until their right of return is guaranteed. Ruba Chavit, Gaza.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
falls off.
When one hears the name of the textile industry, the first thing that comes to mind is the multi-billion dollar fashion industry. That's partially true, but it turns out that textiles have many uses outside of the fashion world. They are an important part of the medical field, toy manufacturing, weaponry, agriculture, and other unexpected fields. The Industrial Revolution indeed expanded this industry over the years. All textiles are made of fibers, and innovation, speed, and flexibility have built the spinning sector as we know it.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This week we will explore the vast textile industry with a particular look at synthetic fibers. We wanted to see where this industry gets its raw material by looking at the contributions of petrochemical sector. We will uncover how synthetic fibers are made and why they are such an integral part of other upstream industries. So let's start spinning this show.
This week, our journey took us to an industrial complex in the town of Karchak, near the capital Tehran. We wanted to see who helps tie the textile industry together, so we visited a manufacturer that specializes in producing synthetic threads. Nasojan Parse Mehris was first established in 2016, and its main product is polyester thread. Its massive production hall has the capacity to produce tons of this item each day. Its products are sold to numerous textile companies across the nation. Mainly, its customers are manufacturers of fabrics for curtains, upholstery, and the garment industry, to name a few. Production all starts with polyester granules, which are made by the petrochemical industry. Partially oriented yarn is made from this material. Dozens of people are employed at the production lines to work in shifts around the clock. Production never really stops at this facility. Partially oriented yarn is a term used to describe a polyester thread that is not completely stretched. This creates a less uniform appearance and is used to make texture in fabrics. This company makes different types of threads which are used for different purposes in down-the-line industries.
Well, there are two main steps to making polyester thread. In the first step, chips are fed to a machine called the vacuum dryer. After roughly 12 hours, the moisture is reduced and then the material is fed through a hopper to an extruder where it is heated and melted. After other steps, it is fed to a machine for pulling. Each step requires accuracy and precision to make high-quality threads.
The beating heart of this company is the quality control unit. Here, threads are tested for their strength and uniformity based on specifications of its productions. The results are then grouped into three categories based on their quality. The highest grades are then packaged and released into the market. Because of Iran's strategic geographical location, this company easily exports its products to Turkey and competes with other big exporters, such as China and India. This manufacturer's main claim to fame is the high quality of its thread. With such large productions, this company is eyeing the expansion of its production facilities. It has already implemented a second phase of production expansion, and the feasibility study for the third phase is in the works. These developments offer numerous investment opportunities as well. Most of the raw material needed to make polyester threads are domestically produced, with the exception of the spin finishes. The majority of finishes need to be imported. These oils are used because of their properties for increasing thread performance and processability of polyester yarns. These features add value to threads, which makes spin finishes a vital ingredient in the production mix. However, the U.S. imposed sanctions have made importing this item difficult over the years.
Polyester has gained a significant role in the textile industry. Some 50 years ago, cotton was the most important fiber in this industry. But over the years, this changed. Population growth meant prioritizing food crops, which decreased the area for cotton cultivation. So demand for polyester fibers grew such that it is now called the king of fibers in the textile industry.
At present, the most important raw material in the textile industry is polyester. It dominates 60% of material used in the textile production cycle. This is followed by cotton and then a small amount of other natural fibers, such as wool and silk. Other synthetic fibers, such as acrylic, nylon, and polypropylene, are also used in this industry, among others. The main raw material used to make polyester threads are granules, which are produced in large amounts in the petrochemical industry. Domestic polyester granule production is dominated by a handful of companies with a combined annual production of over 420,000 tons. That's according to the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. This amount is largely set for the making of polyester threads and is said to be enough for domestic needs. The petrochemical industry also produces other granules, which are used across almost all industrial sectors. Last year, Iran's total thread production stood at around 48,000 tons. 25% of the raw material used in this production was from cotton. That's based on figures from the National Textile Association. The country makes a lot of cotton, but it is still not nearly enough to meet demands. The domestic demand is roughly around 120,000 tons of cotton annually. This is why local productions last year stood at around 60,000 tons.
Polyester is derived from polymers made by the petrochemical industry. It's not surprising that Iran's polymer industry is exponentially expanding given its large oil reserves. Various manufacturing sectors, such as the textile industry, plastics, and even automobile industry, are heavily dependent on petrochemical products. So how are productions in this sector doing?
Currently, over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced each year. That's based on statistics from the National Plastics and Polymer Industrial Association. Of this amount, some 3 million tons of raw material are exported with a value of $3 billion. The other half of total productions is domestically used to make added value products. These items include polyester string, fabrics, tires, dishes, and containers, and a whole lot more. In total, the association puts the combined exports of petrochemical and polymer products at around $12 billion. Iran's Oil, Gas, and Petrochemical Products Exporters Union predicts an increase in added value of petrochemical products. The union estimates products made from petchems will reach a value of $18 billion in exports by the end of this year. The government has implemented policies and initiatives to increase added value through industries that use these raw materials. All in all, there are numerous opportunities in this sector and the ever-growing textile industry. It is an industry that has built a bridge between past and present with an eye on the future.
It's now time for my colleague on the field to take over the show and teach us all something new. Take it away.
Thanks to the Industrial Revolution, springs began being mass-produced around the turn of the 19th century, paving the way for quick and innovative advancement. An improvement in the production of steel meant that it could be made relatively cheaper, allowing the usage of springs to expand at a rapid pace.
In our day-to-day lives, we use a lot of products that utilize springs to achieve their desired motion. What I can think of on the spot are the tiny springs we see in our pens and biros. Now, springs, because of their variety, are also a perfect example of how materials can be manipulated for different applications.
Sazeh Fanarpuyesh is one of the big production companies in Iran that specializes in spring manufacturing. The rise of computer-aided design and drafting has made custom-made creations and cutting down on time, energy, and waste possible. the same CAD software that can be used to design springs big enough to support entire buildings through an earthquake can also create 30 micrometer sized versions for medical use.
A variety of CNC spring machines are used to manufacture extension springs. Now, typically, we use springs to apply an opposing force wherever we need it. Now, in these machines, by making slight adjustments, you can create springs with different tensions in line with the customer's requirements.
Variable factors including wire composition, coil diameter, and the amount of external force can be changed and calculated automatically to allow designers to come up with suitable, cost and time efficient manufacturing designs. The coil spring manufacturing process involves feeding a wire into a set of rollers that pull the spring wire into the wire guides. The said wire then comes into contact with a coiling point that coils the wire backwards, forming a pigtail. New discoveries, such as how heat treatment strengthens certain ferrous metals and alloys after being coiled, allows numerous industries to expand the spring's application.
Treatment oven, and it's the standard equipment in most metalworking facilities. Now, what happens is that springs go into this oven and they are heated to an optimal temperature, and then the cooling process is completely controlled. This helps relieve the stress of the springs. Therefore, it's quite natural that sometimes they are referred to as stress relieving ovens.
Although a spring may seem like a minor component within a large device, functional failure of the spring could result in a device's complete malfunction. Since many products rely on the durability of their springs, it is crucial to select high-quality ones that will not fail prematurely.
Typically, springs are tested to ensure their performance. For example, the device we have to my left is a spring fatigue testing machine that measures a spring's ability to withstand forces in a loading cycle. And the one you have behind me ensures the power of a spring, that the spring can deliver what it says it will. And of course, the device is a salt spray testing device that actually tests the durability of the spring's coating.
Protective coatings are often the most cost-effective method to prolong spring life in corrosive environments. Spring versatility suggests that the manufacture and use of spring technology isn't going to slow down anytime soon.
In the past few decades, the demand for minuscule springs has risen dramatically because of their use in mobile phones, touchpads, and of course other modern electronic devices. So even after thousands of years of evolution, spring technology could have a future that's completely different to what it is today. Who knows, maybe even 4D printing and 2D materials will play a hand in it.
Thank you for that amazing reporting. We're just about out of time, but before we go, let's check out some news and trends in the textile industry. Ever wanted a pair of socks that remain odor-free? Well, an Iranian knowledge-based company which specializes in making nanotextiles has been producing them for years and is now exporting this product.
This company makes a special textile used in these socks, which is antibacterial, antifungal, and anti-odor. This product was mainly produced for diabetic patients who are susceptible to foot ulcers. Recently, this company began exporting its nano socks to neighboring countries as well as European states. Last year, some 8,000 pairs of these advanced socks were exported to Britain alone. Iran has made big advancements in the field of nanotechnology and is ranked fourth in the world for its high-quality nanotech products.
As you know, sportswear is a hot topic, as many people are aiming to reach their fitness goals and stay healthy. Now, a special type of fabric has been created for the first time in Iran, which has cooling properties and is used to make activewear.
An Iranian knowledge-based company used nanotechnology to produce nylon fabrics that cool down the body by reflecting infrared radiation. These nanocomposite fabrics have many functions, including eliminating odors, rapid drying, and increasing blood circulation. The product received nanoscale certification from the National Headquarters of Nanotech Development 2 years ago. It is now part of the HealthX fabric collection manufactured at this nano company.
Silk thread produced in Iran has been used to make clothing fabric and for weaving Persian rugs for millennia. And ancient methods of silk making are still alive among many village communities across Iran.
Traditional silk makers are mainly located in northern Gilan and northeastern Khorasan Razavi provinces. These communities make a living off of this trade the same way their ancestors did some 3,000 years ago. They get their silk cocoons in wooden boxes, mainly from the northern provinces. The cocoons are soaked in hot water to loosen the filaments. Then the threads are hand-spun around spindles. It's a labor-intensive process that can take up to 12 hours to produce 1 kilogram of this valuable thread. While this process has become fully mechanized in many factories, traditional spinning methods still continue in these villages. These activities also offer interesting attractions for tourists.
And that covers our program for today. Let us know what you think about this industry by dropping us a line via email. Also, thank you so much for all the feedback on our Instagram page. Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the vision of Amir al-Mu'mineen wa Sayyid al-Muwahideen Aliyin alayhi salam. Among the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen worked on handily is the fact that he wanted to establish an economical justice in the Muslim society, or for those who were under his control, under his power, under his government, to say the least. Before we say this, it's good to mention that the 25 years that preceded Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Alayhi, it witnessed a cancerous growth when it came to economy in the Muslim world, to such an extent that there were some who pretty much took over everything, and only little few of the Muslims were in power in forms of economy, while the rest of the Muslims, they had nothing. So he came at a time where this division between people in terms of economy was huge. The gap between those who are rich and those who are poor was way too much. So he came to fix something that has been there for over 25 years. And some of the rights of the Muslims were taken. Their lands were taken. Their money was taken. I don't know, they were charged way too much taxes than that they shouldn't have to pay to begin with. So Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Alayhi, when he came, and when he looks at wealth, he says, فَجُنَاتِ أَيْدِيهِمْ لَا تَكُنْ لَغَيْرِ أَفَّاهِهِمْ. Those who work for themselves, they have to feed themselves. They shouldn't be working for other people, giving their money to other people. That should not happen. And then, among the first things that he worked on to establish that equity, to establish that equality when it comes to economy, is the fact that he asked people to give back the money they've taken from others, or whether it's land or wealth, that has to be given to them. That was one of his first approaches to make this gap between those who are rich and those who are poor to minimum. To the extent he said, إِنَّ فِي الْعَدْلِ سِعَةٌ. When it comes to justice, there's a lot of space. وَمَنْ ضَاقَ عَلَيْهِ الْعَدْلِ. And those who see that justice is too narrow for them, then أَجَّوْرَ عَلَيْهِمْ أَضْيَقُ. Oppression is more tighter and more narrower than justice, because he's trying to highlight that a lot of people weren't happy with what Amir al-Mu'mineen was doing. They said, well, why should I give back the money that I have, the lands that I have? He said to them, it's simple, because it's not yours. Justice needs to be applied. You need to give back what you've taken from people. And that was a very harsh concept for them. And then he went and he had to speak out his heart. He had to let out all the, I don't know, I sometimes when I look at Amir al-Mu'mineen and what he went through, I say, this heart of his, this chest of his, I don't know how it could bury so much pain and so much suffering dealing with these pagans. And then he had to explode and say everything in his heart. Now, let us take a short break, and then we listen to Amir al-Mu'mineen speaking his mind out.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Alayhi, when he tried to equalize between people when it comes to wealth and economy, and he tried to take the rights of people back and give it back to them, and those who were wealthy did not like what Amir al-Mu'mineen was doing, he said, Allah, لا يقول رجل منكم غدا قد غمرتهم الدنيا فاتخذوا العقار وفجروا الأنهار وركبوا الخيول الفارهة. He says, let none of you say tomorrow that those who were captivated by this world, that they took fancy houses, they made rivers, they rode on the best of horses, and they took the best of servants in terms of female. إِذَا مَا مَنَعْتَهُمْ مَا كَانُوا يَخُضُونَ فِيهِ. When I stop them from doing what they're doing. So he's trying to highlight that there's a problem. There are those who are having too much, as we say today, real estate, and they have too much rivers, and they have too much fancy horses, in our terms today, fancy cars, and they have good-looking women beside them. This is something that we see even currently, that some people live such a ravish life where in other continents around the world, you see people hardly could survive. He says, if I stop them myself, and I take that from them, and I just give them just their right, they should not come and فَيَنْقُمُونَ ذَلِكَ وَيَقُولُ حَرَمَنَا أَبْنَ أَبِي طَالِبْ حَقَّنَا. And they come and they say, well, the Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, he took our rights. He says, that should not happen. You should not complain, because simply this is not your right. And then he says, أَلَا وَأَيُّمَا رَجُلٌ مِنَ الْمُهَاجِرِينَ وَالْأَنصَارِ مِنْ أَصْحَابِ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ يرى أن الفضل له على من سواه. He says, any supporter or any migrant among the companions of Rasulullah, that he sees that he's better than others because of his closeness to the Prophet or because he was a companion of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa ala, فإن الفضل عند الله, for honor in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, is those who استجاب لله ورسوله, who were obedient to the Prophet and to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That is the criteria that Amir al-Mu'mineen was judging between people. And then he says, "Al-malu malullah," the wealth is Allah's wealth. "Yuqassim baynakum bis-sawiyya," Allah divides it amongst you equally. Why should one of you has fancy castles and one could hardly have a house to live in? Or one of you could have like fancy horses and one doesn't even have anything, only because they're using either riba interest or either they're trying to oppress people or take the right of other people. That's how they manage to be so rich, and these guys manage to be so poor. And he says, لا فضل فيه لأحد على أحد. This wealth of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, no one can say, well, I am better than him in this regard. We are all equal. Then the Imam Salamullah says, وَلِلْمُتَّقِينَ عَنْدَ اللَّهِ غَدًا أَحْسَنُ الْجَزَاءُ وَأَفْضَلُ الثَّوَابُ. For those who are pious, they have the best of reward in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. As mu'mineen, as believers, we are instructed not to live a ravish life. That if I have extra money, instead of me going buying a fancy car that costs, let's say, 100,000 plus, I can just buy a car that is good enough for me. I could buy a car that's worth 50, or at least, let's say, 20, 30, and I give the rest to those who need it. Living that ravished life goes against the core values of Islam. It just means me hogging and taking the rights of others for the sake of my pleasures and desires. We'll leave it here, and we will continue, inshallah, in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.